Hello, and welcome to this episode of Bite Back Chats Books, where we chat to Dr. Nigel Fletcher. Nigel Fletcher is a political historian and has taught at King's College London since 2017. He is the co-founder of the Centre for Opposition Studies and previously worked as a political advisor and was a councillor in the Royal Borough of Greenwich. His book, The Not Quite Prime Ministers, Leaders of the Opposition 1783 to 2020, brings together profiles of the opposition leaders who didn't quite make it to number 10. Today, we'll find out a little bit more about these leaders, uncover insights from behind the scenes, and discuss why it is that opposition is so important. Hi Nigel, great to have you on this episode of Bite Back Chats Books to talk about your new book, The Not Quite Prime Ministers.
Great to be with you.
So where to start really? I mean, this book is all about politicians and leaders of the opposition. You spent quite a lot of time studying the opposition and teaching at King's College London. What got you into politics in the first place?
Into studying it. I mean, I studied politics at undergrad, but I've always been sort of a bit of a practitioner as well as a student of politics, because even on during my undergrad at Queen Mary, I was working in the House of Commons. I worked for David Willetts, who was my local MP from back home in Havant, and he was a shadow minister. He was first of all, I think, a junior education minister, and then he became a member of the shadow cabinet. So I worked for him whilst he was in William Hague's shadow cabinet. So I had that sort of insight into the kind of difficulties of being in opposition, and it was a fascinating sort of experience that we were sitting there in his sort of tiny office in one of the outbuildings of Parliament, and he was for a lot of the period shadowing the Department for Social Security, and they backed onto us. We could see the back of the department, and I always used to look out the window and think, there's thousands of civil servants in there supporting the minister, and when it comes to responding to them in the House of Commons, it's just me. There's me and perhaps one other person from central office who are sort of advising him and helping prepare his speeches. And it just brought home to me the kind of imbalance that there is between the resources the opposition has and the resources the government has. So then later on, when I was working after I'd graduated, I worked first of all in the London Assembly for the Conservative group there in opposition to Ken Livingstone, who was the mayor then, and then went on to the Conservative Research Department. So I was working then first under Michael Howard and then David Cameron for the opposition then. So I've spent a lot of my working career sort of working for the opposition, and it's become a bit of an obsession. And I then went and started my PhD at King's College, looking at the organisation and the history of the opposition. So yeah, it's been a fairly long-standing interest that I've had in looking at the opposition.
Great. And is the study of opposition a modern invention, do you think?
Well, it's one that's not been very well developed, because I think a lot of people, when they're interested in politics, quite understandably, they're interested in power. They're interested in people who actually have the power in politics, and that's something which I think is reflected in the literature. So if you look at the number of books there are on prime ministers, the number of books there are on government, there's a huge number of them. But opposition is fairly under researched, and there are books on opposition. There's some very good ones that I looked at whilst I was studying it, but a lot of them are from quite a long time ago. There's some that were published in the 60s and 70s, looking at opposition in the UK. A man called Robert Dahl, who was an American academic, studied opposition quite a lot. But there's not very much that looks specifically at it as an institution, which is what I'm interested in, and the sort of experience of opposition. You have books about parties, periods in opposition. So people will write about, Tim Bale is very good at writing about political parties, and so he wrote a very good book on Ed Miliband's time in opposition, and there have been a few books recently on Jeremy Corbyn and the phenomenon that was. But they take it much more from a sort of political point of view about the sort of the party politics, whereas what I'm interested in is sort of the experience of being the opposition and actually how that all works. So you know, the experience of, you know, who are these leaders of the opposition, and often people who study these leaders of the opposition, actually they're interested in what they did when they became prime minister. So they're interested in, you know, Harold Wilson before he became prime minister. They're interested particularly in Blair. There's a lot of writing that's been done about Tony Blair's time in opposition, preparing New Labour to take government. So looking at those who didn't make it is something that doesn't often get done.
Yeah. And you say in the book, history is written by the winners. Do you think now we live in a time of slim margins? I'm thinking of the Scottish referendum and the Brexit referendum. Do you think the often 50-50 polarising stance means that actually national sentiment, or a good proportion of it, won't be recorded accurately because of history is only recorded by the winners?
Yes, it is a bias. I mean, we've just started teaching this term, and I started with a session yesterday sort of talking to our students about history and how we sort of do contemporary history. And you have to be aware of the biases in the material that you're looking at. And one of the big biases is this sort of selection bias of, you know, if you're only reading accounts of people who've made it, then you're not learning the lessons of those who didn't, because people aren't interested in them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think there is this imbalance, and it does change how you view things. I always think that these sort of self-help books by sort of very successful business people are a bit of a con, because more often than not, they've got there by more luck than judgment. You know, there are thousands of businesses that fail, and some of them survive and some of them sort of succeed, and then they write these books saying, well, this is how I did it. And you sort of think, well, I'm sure there are lots of other people who did all of those things, did exactly the same things, and didn't make it. But we don't record those. They don't get to write the best-selling book about it. You know, how they sort of, you know, started Alan Sugar style, selling things from the back of a cart, you know, in the market, and built their way up and whatever. You know, lots of people will have done that and then went bankrupt or failed. So, you know, there's lots of things that, and the same is true in politics. I think, you know, we read books by people who've succeeded, who've become prime minister, and then they sort of talk about how they did it and how they got to be leader, and then how they got to be prime minister. But one of the things I've really been struck by writing this book is just how much of a role luck plays in all of this. There are lots of leaders here. By definition, the ones in this book are those who didn't make it, but many of them quite clearly could have done, and had things happened just slightly differently, then they would have done. There's very, as you say, very narrow margins between success and failure. And to my mind, success and failure in politics is, you know, it can't be the be all and end all of it. And particularly in opposition, there's an important job to be done in holding the government to account, providing an alternative, and allowing people the choice at an election that exists whether or not you win at the end of the day.
So let's talk a bit about the writing process. You've got some big names in there, and you've got some that people don't really know of, or people who haven't really been in opposition for more than a minute. Yes. Where and who did you start with?
Well, it all came out of a series I did for Times Radio. So it started last year when Matt Chorley, who presents the mid-morning show on Times Radio, contacted me to ask if I wanted to come on the show every week to do a different leader of the opposition, with the one rule being that they couldn't be the ones who won, because the previous year they did the same with prime ministers, so he didn't want to repeat them. So I sort of had, during the course of last year, a sort of treadmill every week of researching a new leader every week to go and talk about on the radio. So that's the sort of order I had them in, was chronologically. I had Charles James Fox for, you know, I had to decide where to start. And Charles James Fox is the one I picked because he's such a big figure. You know, anyone who studied political history will know of the name, more so actually than a lot of people who did become prime minister, who have been lost to history. And so I started with him as this big figure who, you know, I think unequivocally was a leader of the opposition, who was a credible alternative prime minister for a lot of the period he was doing that. And so he seemed an obvious place to start. And, you know, it's a fascinating character. I mean, his personal life, his sort of his ability in the chamber, he was a great orator. And so just a really colourful character. So he was a good one to start with. And so, yeah, I'd started with him on the radio the previous year. And so when I came to write the book, I had all my notes, but I soon discovered that those didn't take me very far. You know, I'd got my sort of notes, which had been sort of culled from Wikipedia and from the Dictionary of National Biography, which I have to say is a great resource, actually, the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. I'd sort of, you know, put together notes to be able to talk about all of these leaders for 5 minutes on the radio. But when you're turning that into a couple of thousand words of a biography, and you know, you have to sort of go a bit deeper. So, you know, that was my starting point. But there was a lot of extra research I had to do. But because it came from Times Radio, I wanted to sort of have a bit of a nod to that. And so one of the things I had done during the course of the year occasionally was to dip into the Times archive to look at mostly, you know, their obituaries is a great sort of place to start for a good overview of their life. But there are other incidents during their life that I was able to go and have a quick look at. And some of them, where there's been a notable incident, that was really quite amusing. But then writing the book, I went back to that. And so I spent a lot of time looking at contemporary coverage from the Times in particular of all of these leaders. And it is a great resource, I have to say, as a, you know, someone who loves archives. It goes from 1785 all the way up to the present day. Subscribers, I think, to the Times can actually look, can get access to most of it. But it finishes in 1985. But when I got towards that end of it, there are some that come a bit closer up. But yeah, it goes all the way back sort of to basically the start of the period I'm looking at. The book goes from 1783 and the Times archive starts in 1785. So
fantastic.
Really good resource to be able to dip into.
So there are some really wonderful and some quite weird stories in there. I'm thinking of the dueling, the slightly James Bond-esque story. Mm. But could you just give us a flavour of one or two that you think our listeners
I'll go for the ones that you mentioned there, because it became a bit of a running theme when we were doing the show as well, that it seemed every week I was talking about a leader of the opposition who'd been involved in a duel. But yeah, so you had, Fox himself sort of made a bit of a joke about the fact that he was involved in a duel. The most famous one was George Tierney, who was the third leader in the book. He was the person who had the famous duel on Putney Heath with the Prime Minister, William Pitt. And a lot of people know about the fact that Pitt as Prime Minister was involved in a duel, and very few people know who it was that he was facing. And it's quite striking that you've got a leading opposition figure. He wasn't quite the leader at the time. It was about 20 years before he became leader, but he was a leading opposition MP. And this was a row in the House of Commons. You know, he was accused by the Prime Minister of a lack of patriotism, told the Prime Minister he wanted him to retract that. He refused and called him out. So they went and had this duel where, you know, it was... And the funny story about that is that Pitt is notoriously, you know, is a very thin man. Mm. George Tierney, not so much, a bit more stocky.
So a bit more to aim at then.
A bit more to aim at. So there was a suggestion that this was an unfair contest. So there were a few like that. So there's a couple of duels of that. And the other one you mentioned, the James Bond story, I absolutely love this one because I discovered this. There was an oblique reference to it in one of the accounts I read, and I went and dug out the original source for it. This was when Hugh Gaitskell, who was leader of the Labour Party from 1955 until he died in 1963, prior to Harold Wilson becoming leader. He was famously now, although in a lot of the biographies it was published before this was known, was having an affair with the wife of Ian Fleming, who wrote the James Bond novels. And this is fairly well accepted now that they were involved in this relationship. And I was quite struck by the fact that on one occasion, Hugh Gaitskell actually went to Jamaica, where Ian Fleming and his wife had their villa, Goldeneye, on the island. And he went there on an official visit to speak to some of the leaders of the local party, I think the local Labour Party in Jamaica. But whilst he was there, he stayed at Goldeneye. And so you have this sort of slightly odd situation where he's staying there as the guest of Ian Fleming and his wife, who he's having an affair with. And so you've got this sort of drama there already.
Yeah, reality TV.
Exactly. So yes, exactly. I don't watch Love Island, but it's a little bit like that. but you then had the press sort of got onto the fact that he was there. And I don't know whether it was known particularly that this relationship was going on. I suspect it probably was. The gossip was probably circulating about this. So they had the paparazzi descend on Goldeneye. You then have Hugh Gaitskell, leader of the Labour Party, sort of leaving the compound, sort of driving out with Ian Fleming's wife to take her. I think they said that he was taking her swimming, and then notices the press are there. And then sort of tries to evade them. And so you have this kind of paparazzi pursuit where the press start driving after them, and they go on this kind of, as I say, this very sort of James Bond story where he's sort of being pursued by the press and tries to sort of shake them off, drops Anne Fleming off around the corner at the post office, and then sort of flees to the hills and ends up hiding in a shop somewhere several miles away. And manages to get a message back to a friend of his, a neighbor of Ian Fleming, to say, can you come and rescue me? Can you come and pick me up? And then goes back to the place. And the press is still there. And so instead of sort of hiding down and sort of evading them by ducking down in the car, he gets out of the car and hides in the bushes. And so, you know, and then he puts gets a message sort of taken into to the Flemings to sort of say, you know, I'm outside hiding in the bushes, can you come and rescue me? And it's quite extraordinary, you know.
That's so extraordinary,
it's a brilliant story, and it had been published. There was a book that had been written by one of the neighbors of Ian Fleming about his time in Jamaica, and it's this fairly obscure book that I had to track down in Senate House Library, and it was published in the 70s, and as far as I can see, it wasn't really picked up very much. So particularly given at the time it wasn't generally acknowledged that this affair had taken place, although, as I say, I think it was common gossip at the time. So with that in mind, it's quite interesting sort of seeing how that all panned out. A real James Bond story for the 60s there.
That's brilliant. So I reckon in the book there's a bit of a shift between House leaders of the opposition. It was around the earlier 20th century when there was a reform to do with the House of Lords not being able to be Prime Minister. For those who aren't as clued in on constitutional history, can you just give us a bit of a breakdown on how this operated and when opposition really came into force in this way?
Yes. Well, one of the complicating factors about defining who was leader of the opposition and who was the not quite prime minister, the aspirant prime minister, is that throughout the sort of 18th and into the 19th century, it could have been someone from either the House of Commons or the House of Lords who could be prime minister. And so you have it alternating. If you look at the list of prime ministers, there is another complicating factor, which is that you often have people with titles in the House of Commons, but that's taking it a bit too far, which was very confusing. There are people with what's known as courtesy titles. So if you're the heir to a dukedom, you will generally have a subsidiary title that you use. So you have this odd situation where, for example, one of my favourites in the book is was known as the Marquess of Hartington. So that sounds like he's a peer, but he wasn't. He was an heir to a title, so he was actually in the House of Commons. So that's very confusing. But you did actually also have someone leading the opposition in the House of Lords, and often they were the senior figure. So if that was the case, then you would have somebody there who was likely to become the Prime Minister if that party then sort of took office, because they were the senior partner. Or you sometimes had somebody in the House of Commons who was the preeminent person. So they alternated, and you look at that through the list of prime ministers. So defining who was the leader of the opposition was quite difficult. So I've got sort of both of them in there. So I take the story through both the House of Commons and the House of Lords, where you've got a leader of the opposition in both. And that sort of, as you say, that does stop at the start of the 20th century, because Lord Salisbury was the last prime minister to come from the House of Lords. And then you had the House of Lords reforms, the Parliament Act 1911, which curtailed the power of the House of Lords. And so prior to that, they could block legislation, and there was a big crisis over the Liberal budget, and they were stripped of that power, so they could only delay it. And really from then on, it was quite clear that the House of Commons was the preeminent house. And from then on, we only had prime ministers from the House of Commons. And if you were a leader of the opposition in the House of Lords, you were not a contender to be prime minister. So at that point, I then shift to just looking at the House of Commons.
And whose history looked upon more favorably than the contemporary audience?
Well, that's an interesting one. I think there are people who at the time were viewed as being very unsuccessful in the job who I think have been reappraised afterwards. Mm. I always lean on Neil Kinnock for this one because I just think he is a very good example of someone who spent, you know, over 8 years doing the job unsuccessfully, fought two elections and lost, but yet I think had a great record of success in terms of reforming his party and getting the Labour Party from, as I've described it in the past, from the brink of annihilation to the brink of government, and laying the foundations for New Labour and Tony Blair to take over. And so I think he's someone who I think has been viewed much more sympathetically historically. William Hague, to some extent, but for different reasons. You know, he did what he described as the night shift in opposition, in a sort of thankless task of opposing a government with a massive majority with no chance really of coming back. But he also made no progress at the next election, so he only increased the Conservative seat tally by one at the next election. So by any measure, he wasn't a success in the job, although you can say he did things like he reformed the party, modernized some of the structures of the party, which has still had an effect, introduced the election for the leader by the membership, which is something which perhaps perhaps the party might be regretting at times, but that was one of the significant reforms. So he was another one of these people who sort of, you know, lifted the bonnet and sort of, you know, and tried to sort of fix the car a bit whilst it was off the road. So in that sense, I think, you know, he did a bit of that. But if you read accounts of his leadership from, I've mentioned it before, but people like Tim Bale, who's written about the Conservative Party in that time, it's difficult to say that he was anything other than a bit of a failure in that job. But his reputation since then, because he then went on to become foreign secretary, he was a leading figure in the coalition government and very well respected. So his personal reputation has, I think, increased and is now seen as a very authoritative and wise sort of elder statesman. But he wasn't really a success in the job, and I don't think that's really been revised. But yeah, some of the earlier ones. I say one of the interesting things to do by looking at the Times coverage was you got a sense of how they were viewed at the time. And also reading their obituaries. And one of the things I absolutely love about the Times obituaries is the sort of waspish sense of humour of the obituary writers. There's a real turn of phrase there where they damn with faint praise. And so you have sort of, particularly with some of the aristocrats who kind of did it out of a sense of duty rather than any great sort of political ability, where they essentially sort of say, you know, his estate workers say that he was a very nice man kind of thing. It's sort of like, you know, he was very proud of his prizes for cattle, you know, and this sort of thing. And you just sort of can see the sort of sardonic kind of disdain dripping from these, you know, just after the person's died, you know, and they're writing their obituary, and you can sense that this real sense of damning them with faint praise, that, you know, nobody would say that he was of the finest sort of intellectual caliber, but, you know, his heart was in the right place kind of thing. Is that sort of thing. So there's a particular style I got used to reading in these, particularly in the mid-19th century, that's if you enjoy that kind of thing, I've tried to include some of those quotes in there, which, as I say, is a bit of an art form. But it does show you that you know, even at the time, some of these people were viewed as not being terribly successful. And some of them, I think, a bit unfairly. You know, I've looked at some of them and thought they were being a bit harsh about them. Whereas actually, if you look at what they did, for some of them, I've said that even staying in the job for a period of time is actually quite an achievement, particularly now when we look at the brutality of politics now, where people are dispatched pretty quickly if they don't make progress. I mean, George Ponsonby, the second one in the book, he was in the job for about a decade, despite the fact that even from day one, people were saying he was useless. So you know, you do have that sticking power sometimes.
How many people didn't really want to do it, do you reckon, in the earlier part of the book? And we're kind of forced into it.
Yeah, a lot of them. I mean, there's particularly, as I say, the aristocrats, the sort of, you know, the Earl Spencers. I'm just looking down the list now, and it's generally the sort of people who were party grandees who sort of had to sort of step forward into the role. And of course, you know, what tended to happen, and the reason that a lot of them are in the book was because they didn't become prime minister, was because the people who were in contention to be prime minister didn't want to do it. You know, they lost office. And then just sort of went off, and you know, the aristocrats went off to their estates, and others sort of went off and sort of in a bit of a huff. Mm. They didn't want to do the hard yards of leading the opposition out of power. But the worst example of that, I thought, was the way that Gladstone behaved towards one of my favourites, the Marquess of Hartington I mentioned before, who we might talk about in a moment, why I particularly enjoy him. But you know, Hartington sort of led the opposition up to the election in 1880, I think it was, and you know, won the election, was invited to form a government, and at that point Gladstone, who had been prime minister before and then sort of retired, decided he wanted a comeback, and so he made it very clear that he would not be willing to serve under or support a government of which he wasn't leading, and so he sort of elbowed Hartington out of the way and came back as prime minister. So that, I think, you know, is one of the things that you tend to see here, that it's a pretty tough job, where you don't really have a queue of people wanting to do it. And that's definitely something I've noticed in the first sort of chapters, that you have a succession of people where often the person is the fourth or fifth choice. The number of times where you have accounts that say, you know, they asked the Earl of Derby, he said no. They asked Earl Spencer, he said no. And, you know, and then you get down to somebody who just out of a sense of duty sort of says, okay, I'll take it on, have a go. Yeah, exactly. Wow.
And I mean, that story about Gladstone kind of reminds me of some more modern day politicians. Did you have any fun reading through all these obituaries and things and thinking of modern day politicians and what parallels we can draw? Are there any that spring to mind?
Yeah, there are some parallels. I mean, one that I think is particularly interesting is George Lansbury, who was a Labour leader of the opposition. He led the opposition from 1931 to 1935, after the big Labour landslide defeat in 31, after their split.
Yeah.
And Lansbury, similar actually to what we were just talking about, he was somebody who didn't really ever think that he was going to be leader of the party. There were plenty of other people who might have been more qualified, but a lot of them were out of parliament. They lost, you know, basically most of their leadership, and so he was someone who had been a junior minister. He'd been actually I think Minister of Works in the second Labour government, and so he had a bit of experience, but he was not a sort of leadership minded person. He was a real left winger, a rebel. And the parallels I see there with Jeremy Corbyn are really striking. And when Corbyn became leader, and during his leadership, he was often spoken of as though he was this great exception, unprecedented for us to have a leader of the opposition who was so anti-establishment and so left wing. And it's just not true. I mean, you look at Lansbury, and he's very much a left wing figure, someone who was a Republican. You know, there was some question marks over whether he would be an appropriate person to join the Privy Council when he was a cabinet minister. And similar to Corbyn, all of these questions came up again. And going back even further, even Fox, you know, the Whigs and the Liberals, we forget sometimes that the Labour Party, when it began in the turn of the 20th century, from 1900 on, the Labour Party as the Workers' Party sort of took on that mantle. But prior to that, the Radical Party was the Liberal Party and the Whigs. And so they had this association. We're familiar now with Labour leaders trying to sort of control the excesses of their left wing. Well, the Liberals had the similar thing, and the Whigs. So Charles James Fox and some of the other leaders in the early part of the book, you know, they were speaking on platforms with radical Liberals and radical sort of reformers, and this was all quite anti-establishment. You know, this is a time when lots of people didn't have the vote, and so speaking to a rally of people and telling them that they should come out on demonstrations and lobby Parliament was quite a radical thing to do. So there's lots of those kind of parallels that I see when you're looking at some of those earlier ones, and we often, I think, are quite short-sighted in our view of politics, that if something hasn't happened in the last 10 years, we think that it's unprecedented. Whereas if you look a bit further back, there are examples of all of these things that have happened before.
And as you were just talking about Jeremy Corbyn, you say in the book, sometimes it is hard to convince people why it matters who the leader of the opposition is. After Jeremy Corbyn, it should be obvious. Why is opposition quite so important?
Well, I would say opposition matters for a number of reasons. One of which is, if it becomes the government, there is an obvious interest in how they form their policy, what their policies are. People want to know, you know, what will the government do in future? So there's that interest. That's not really so much what we're talking about here. What we're talking about in this book generally is how the quality of the opposition in the here and now also matters.
Yeah.
And that's something which I think is another main reason why opposition does matter, because the government has a an ability to legislate. They're always going to win the vote in parliament. That's not really the issue, but the amount of scrutiny they come under from the opposition can often shape their choices. So, you know, if there's going to be a rebellion, if the government are going to lose a vote, they're only going to lose it if the opposition unites against them with some rebels on their own side. So tactics in opposition are quite important. And so if a leader is able to be quite clever and outflank the government in a particular way, in a way they know is going to split the government party, then they can possibly have a chance of defeating them, winning a vote. That's quite important. And those kind of things. But also, in respect to Corbyn, we were looking at a period of time when Parliament was gridlocked, where you had the sort of interminable Brexit debates. And there was a real opportunity there because both parties were so split and there were so many different sort of factions. We were almost returning, I think, to a sort of 18th century, 19th century Parliament, where we had much less fixed party blocks, much more rebellious, independent-minded MPs.
Little factions, yeah.
Yes, and people sort of following particular groupings, and even, you know, with the independent group of Labour MPs sort of hiving off. And so you had all of that going on. And so within that context, who is leader of the opposition and what the opposition as a large block in that are doing is really important. And I think that the accounts we've seen now about how the negotiations sort of went between the parties and between sort of the factions, there was, I think, an opportunity for the Labour Party to exert much more influence than I think it ended up doing, because Jeremy Corbyn, just himself, was constitutionally, I think, not really capable of of working with Conservatives. He was someone very averse to doing that. Whereas I think had he been a more pragmatic and perhaps a less unconventional leader of the opposition, if he'd been someone who was perhaps a bit more canny with his political game playing, might have been able to achieve some wins. There was a point in the Brexit saga where it struck me that, you know, if you had a different leader of the opposition who wasn't quite so toxic to the Conservatives and wasn't seen as being quite such an extremist, then the Labour Party at that time really could have made an influence and could have demanded whatever they wanted in return for backing the deal. So there's lots of things like that where, you know, suddenly the opposition does matter. And of course, the very fact that we had the 2017 election with Theresa May trying to increase her majority was caused by the fact that the Conservatives were 20 points ahead of Labour. It looked like a slam dunk they were going to win. And so the weakness of the opposition was what caused that election. Of course, it was actually the weakness of the Conservatives that led to the outcome of that. And Jeremy Corbyn did much better than was expected. But then you get to 2019 and his weakness and the Labour Party's weakness at that election massively changed the situation then again. So yes, I think Corbyn is a sort of extreme example of it, but who the opposition is and how effective they are in doing that job can make a real impact in the here and now.
Yeah. And so I think one last more fun question, if that's all right, Nigel. If you could have, I mean, you obviously love all of your leaders of the opposition, but if you could have dinner with three of them, who would you pick and why?
Oh gosh, three of them. Well, I'll have to put Neil Kinnock in there. I just have to, because I declare an interest. I know him a bit through my work with the Centre for Opposition Studies, and he is great company. He can tell some wonderful stories. So I like Neil. So I'll have him in my list. Mm-hmm. I think actually Hugh Gateschool also, you know, our James Bond hero as well. he is notorious of, you know, for having been a great bon vivant and quite a fun character. I ought to have someone from another party other than the Labour Party. So I think I might go back and have a look at who would I want as my third one.
It'd be a bit chaotic to have Fox in at a dinner party. Do you know what I think?
Well, that's that. Yeah, he would try and drink you under the table. Yeah. That's the problem there. I think it would be quite a dangerous thing to try and have. I'm gonna go for my old friend Hearty Tarty. I'm gonna go for him. Sure. The Marquess of Hartington, because he's got the best nickname.
Yeah. Do you think you'd all get on at the dinner party? Do you reckon there'd be some good stories then?
Yes, and I'd be interested to hear their reflections on the sort of shared experience of being leader of the opposition. People often say it's the worst job in politics. I disagree with that. I think there are far worse jobs in politics than being leader of the opposition. But I think that, you know, having people who've done the job reflecting on how difficult it might be, I think would be quite interesting, particularly sort of some from the 19th century.
Exactly.
Comparing notes with Neil Kinnock would be quite interesting.
Well, brilliant. So your book, The Not Quite Prime Ministers, Leaders of the Opposition, 1783 to 2020, is out now. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Nigel.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Bite Back podcast. The Not Quite Prime Ministers, Leaders of the Opposition, 1783 to 2020, is out now. Head to the Bite Back website to use exclusive 20% off code PM20. And do get in touch with us on Twitter with your questions or queries at Bite Back Pub.